Looks as if everyone is present, ready to go. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Riley, Judge Patfold, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our last Zoom Gov argument of the day, and I will call the case State of Minnesota Respondent versus Davion Lee Jones as appellant. This is court file number A19-1625. Each of you has 15 minutes to present your argument. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to you, Ms. Bond, if you wish to use that for rebuttal purposes. And without saying anything else, just a reminder, introduce yourself and which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. The time clock is also appearing on one of your screens. Ms. Bond, when you're ready to go, you may.
Good morning. Can the court hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Bond representing the appellant, Davion Jones. Mr. Jones was convicted after a jury trial of drive-by shooting at an occupied building and assault. And in this direct appeal, we are asking that those convictions be reversed for insufficient evidence. We are also asking alternatively that Mr. Jones be given a new trial because of two errors. First, the district court erroneously declined to instruct that Zaurice Stewart was an accomplice as a matter of law. And second, the district court erroneously admitted the Spriegel evidence. One, I'll call it a housekeeping matter. I did also raise a sentencing issue in my brief. I will agree with respondent that in light of State versus Branch that was issued by the Minnesota Supreme Court after I filed my brief, that that issue really has been disposed of by Branch, which does authorize the multiple sentences for both the drive-by and the assault. I don't plan to talk about that sentencing issue today. I would like hopefully to touch on the remaining three issues, and with the court's permission, I might take them in reverse order from my brief. Talk about the Spriegel issue first, and then I think it makes some sense, as respondent said in its brief, to do a threshold issue for both the sufficiency and the jury instruction, which is the status of Zaurice Stewart and whether she in fact was an accomplice as a matter of law, because that does impact both the sufficiency and the jury instruction issue. So,
Ms. but Bond, could I just ask a question? Your brief got me thinking about the distinction between an accomplice and an aider and abettor. And can you give me your thoughts on the difference and kind of where they intersect and where they are distinct?
Sure, and there is overlap in those concepts, and I think the case law, it is sometimes intellectually a little convoluted, because sometimes when we talk about aiding and abetting, we're talking about an accomplice. And so those two overlap. I would say the significance, an aider and abettor is, I think we can generally agree, an accomplice. What is the more specific issue here is when the accomplice actually testifies and provides evidence against the defendant. And that triggers the application of 634.04, which requires that the testimony be corroborated.
So would you say that all aiders and abettors are accomplices? They're a subset of accomplices, or the opposite, the other way around?
I think that all aiders and abettors are accomplices. I suppose not.
I might disagree with you, because you can have an... So we had just reviewed a case where someone helped people after they'd committed a murder. So they're aiding and abetting, but they weren't necessarily accomplices in the... So maybe accomplice is a subset of aider and abettor.
That's true. No, maybe that's true. I think that's true. I think that whenever you have someone who is providing accomplice testimony and the theory in the case is an aiding and abetting theory, you almost both of those concepts often come into play. What's important here is that, this case was a little complicated. It just took me a little while to work through how I was going to raise the issues on appeal, because we do have different theories of liability accomplice testimony that has to be corroborated, direct and circumstantial evidence. I think what's important here is the aiding and abetting liability comes into play in two places. One is that the jury returned a verdict for purposes of how this court is reviewing the sufficiency of both principal liability and aiding and abetting liability. Both things were submitted to the jury. I read this case a little bit consistently, I think, with the prosecutor's theory at trial, that the theory was my client was the shooter. There really is not much evidence as to what he might have done to intentionally aid Corey Dixon if Corey Dixon was the shooter. But notwithstanding, the state submitted both theories, so that's where we are. So we've got aiding and abetting in this case, that was a potential theory of liability for my client. It also is how the theory of liability under which Zori Stewart could be charged and convicted as the same crime as my client, which is under an aider and abetter theory of liability. And at the same time, we have definitely accomplice testimony from Courtney Dixon. And under my theory, definitely accomplice testimony from Zori Stewart. So,
and Courtney Dixon was charged with the same crimes.
Correct. And the jury and the district court instructed the jury that she was an accomplice as a matter of law. And I can just start with the, if we're on the subject of accomplice liability and aiding and abetting, would the court prefer that I start with the issue of Zori Stewart's accomplice testimony?
You can start with any issue you want.
Okay. Well, I guess let me start there since that's where we are. And hopefully I will have time to talk about the Spriegel because I think that's a very important issue. So the state proposed in its brief that there is this threshold issue, we'll call it, of Zori Stewart's status as an accomplice. And that is relevant, as I mentioned before, to both issue one, which is the sufficiency of the evidence, and issue two, which is the jury instruction. And I would agree with that. I would say one caveat, if this is the way the court is going to think about it, that once the court decides Zori Stewart's status as an accomplice as a matter of law or not, the next issue, it should be sufficiency of the evidence, because sufficiency of the evidence is the broader relief. And if we prevail on that theory because Zori Stewart was an accomplice as a matter of law and her accomplice testimony and Courtney's accomplice testimony were not adequately corroborated, if we win on that, then it's a reversal and it bars a retrial. What I would urge the court not to do, if you agree that Zori Stewart is an accomplice as a matter of law, is then to decide the jury instruction issue, because that's a different remedy. So if that makes sense. But the fundamental reason why the district court erred as to Ms. Stewart is that, as the court knows, the test is, does the evidence compel a single inference, which is that she could be charged with and convicted of the same crime as my client? And what we're talking about here is, was there enough evidence that she could be charged and convicted with aiding and abetting an assault because she knew that Courtney or Corey intended to commit a crime and she intended her actions to help? And then my client was also the theory, there was the expansive theory of liability was given, which is to say that the aider and abettor is liable for any other crime that's committed if it's reasonably foreseeable. And in this case, it was reasonably foreseeable that there would have been a shooting, a drive-by shooting at the occupied building, given what we have in the record.
I was going to ask you about the record because, as I read it, the only evidence that Zorice might have known that a firearm would be used came from Courtney's statement that nobody shoot nobody. Is there evidence in the record that Zorice heard that statement by Courtney?
Yes, and that was not the only evidence. So to answer the first thing, Courtney was very specifically asked by the prosecutor, so who did you make that statement to, nobody shoot anybody? And Courtney said, everybody was there. And then she lists off the specific people who were there, including Zori Stewart. So it's absolutely undisputed from the record that Zori's heard that statement. The other thing, sort of body of evidence that's quite important in deciding this issue of Zoris's status.
So Ms. Bond, before you go ahead, what was Ms. Stewart's answer when she asked the question, the same question?
As to whether she heard that statement? I would have to check. I don't recall. If her testimony is, I didn't hear that statement, then that was, you know, that was her testimony.
My point is really to get you to talk about the argument that respondents are making, which is that there is evidence pointing both ways as to whether Ms. Stewart is an accomplice. The judge did not in any way, well, the judge attempted to, let's put it this way, I think, stating it the way the judge saw the case, the district court tried to charge the jury in such a way that the jury would decide whether Ms. Stewart was an accomplice. And so if there is evidence pointing both ways, it seems to support the district court's decision. So would you address that aspect of the record?
Yes, and I will say a couple of things in response to that. The focus of that answer is not only on what Zoris Stewart testified to, because when we look at whether a defendant or a person could be charged with and convicted of a crime, what of course prosecutors do is look at the entirety of their evidence. And so what is missing for me from the state's argument on this point is Courtney's testimony and the Facebook posts. And it is undisputed that Zoris Stewart heard the Facebook Live exchange and read the posts on Facebook, which were introduced as exhibits at trial. And those Facebook comments talk about shooting. And they talk about, paraphrase to avoid bad language, beating people up. And so that is part of what makes it undisputed that she knew Courtney intended to commit a crime. And so I think to focus too narrowly on whether she heard a specific statement or not, a little bit is putting the focus in the wrong direction, because what we're doing is looking at the entirety of the evidence and saying, not could it have turned out differently, but what did she know about Courtney's intent to commit a crime? And I read only one conclusion from the entirety of the evidence, that she knew that Courtney was going there to commit an assault. She knew that Courtney was going there to fight. And then it became reasonably foreseeable because of these references in the record to shooting and guns.
Going to what Judge Bradfield said, the testimony indicates that she didn't know what was going to happen. She said she didn't know if they were just going to be arguing, whether there's going to be a fight, didn't know what the details were. And then of course, when Sean did not, what was obvious he was not going to come out, she said, let's just get out of here, words to that effect. I mean, these are things that dispute what you're saying. So we have a question that would ultimately go to the jury to decide if she would be an accomplice or not. How do we resolve that? There's different versions of the testimony.
Well, I don't think, again, I think that by the time Zoris or Ms. Stewart is on cross-examination, it becomes pretty clear as I read the record that she knew that Courtney was going to have a confrontation and was going to have and was intending to fight. And so the fact that she was making observations later, once she's at the scene about leaving, I don't think bring into dispute the fact that the evidence supports that she knew at the time she took the step to help, going along, giving the car to the people, to the two men, she knew that there was an intent to commit a crime. So I think reading the entirety of the evidence there, it really does only compel one conclusion. And I'm quite short on time again. And I will say, I guess the other thing is, if the court disagrees and thinks that the jury instruction was correct, then what that means is that the significance to that, to the sufficiency issue, is that Ms. Stewart's testimony can corroborate Courtney's accomplice testimony. But I would not concede that completely dooms the first issue, because Courtney's accomplice testimony is the thing that ties my client to being the shooter. And Zoris's testimony certainly corroborates part of that and it puts him at the scene in the car. But the statement that we're talking about is, don't worry, nothing happened in your car. That doesn't speak to whether my client committed the offense. So even if Ms. Stewart's testimony can be used to corroborate Courtney's testimony, I would certainly not concede that that makes the evidence, the non-accomplice testimony evidence, sufficient to corroborate Courtney's testimony. I'm going to make 30 seconds worth of points on the Spriegel, and then I would be happy to follow up on that in rebuttal. I would note that this issue has been crystallized for the court a bit because the state is not arguing that if there was any error, it was harmless. I appreciate that position. I think that's the only reasonable way to read the record. I would ask the court to focus very specifically on the thing that the prosecutor articulated as the disputed issue of fact. And my client's access to guns and ability to shoot a gun, even one that shot ammunition that was consistent with the kind of ammunition fired at the Royster home, was simply not in dispute. And I would note that the state really doesn't cite a single case in its brief that shows why this evidence would be admissible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bond. We'll turn now to respondent attorney.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The state is asking this court to affirm the appellant's convictions and sentence. And given Ms. Bond's concession regarding the sentence, I will just focus on the issues relating to the trial and the case. I'd like to begin with the question of Ms. Zurise Stewart's status as an accomplice, whether she was an accomplice as a matter of law or whether it was up to the jury to decide. And I think any fair reading of the evidence in full would one would come to the conclusion that she could be an accomplice, but she also might not be. It's just not clear. Perhaps the best way to come to that conclusion, I noticed this when I was rereading the closing arguments in preparation for this argument, is that both sides, I thought, made reasonable arguments as to whether Ms. Stewart was or was not an accomplice. When both sides can make arguments like that, that are very reasonable arguments based on the evidence presented, then that person isn't an accomplice as a matter of law. And the fact is, Ms. Stewart's testimony.
So, Mr. Hajdukovich, I realize that in making that argument, you're relying on some very clear Minnesota case law that you've cited mm-hmm. in your brief, and the appellants discussed it too, that suggests where there is a question of fact about whether a witness could be charged as an accomplice, and that issue should go to the jury. Here's what my question for you is if it really is a question of whether Ms. Stewart could be charged, should the analysis really be whether there was probable cause to charge Ms. Stewart as an accomplice? And that is a legal question, not one for the jury. So it's one that district courts decide all the time. So would you comment on that?
Sure. That's an interesting question. And I think that the answer is, I can see where you're coming from with that, but I think the answer probably has to be no, in part because that gets us away from deciding those questions of fact, because obviously in the probable cause determination, we really just look to if the jury believes evidence X, regardless of what other evidence might show to the contrary, this person could be charged and in theory convicted of the crime. And you know, that one could make the argument that that's the way the law should be, but I think that this court and the Supreme Court have made clear that it really isn't. And I think maybe the better way to, and because it, a person can be charged in theory on very, very thin evidence, and that doesn't make them an accomplice. And what the case law does is, I agree that maybe the language in the case is about whether the person could be charged is perhaps not the most well-advised language. Given that a person can be charged on very thin evidence, but then what the courts have said is when you have these cases where maybe they're an accomplice, maybe they're not, depends on what you believe, then that question has to be decided by the jury. So maybe another way to put it is, could they be charged as an accomplice if the jury finds the facts that would demonstrate that they're an accomplice and does not find the facts that would demonstrate they're not an accomplice? But the problem is, of course, we'd never know the answer to that question because of our, you know, how we do verdict forms in Minnesota. So maybe that's another way to look at it that gets you to the same place, but it puts us in a position where we just will never find out in most cases at least, what the answer is, because the jury doesn't report that information back to us. So what I would say though is that the testimony from Ms. Stewart is very much equivocal about whether she knew that there was going to be an assault. And I'd say the testimony is equivocal about, you know, what she knew about whether there was going to be a gun or not.
But that's not surprising, because she obviously would want to cast herself in the best light possible.
Right. That's certainly entirely possible that that was her motive for testifying that way. Although what I will say is that I feel like it's she wasn't, as far as the record indicates, represented by counsel. And that makes sense, because she was never charged with anything. And it would be a fairly sophisticated, I feel like, response on her part to kind of hedge the way she did to avoid legal liability. But I can't rule that out as a motive. But I think that's why we let the jury make that decision, because people do have various motives. I mean, that's why we require the corroboration.
So, would you address the two pieces of evidence that Ms. Bond relied on? So that would be Courtney's statement, which she said she made to the entire room, nobody shoot nobody. And then the Facebook posts that indicated that there would be a fight, physical confrontation. Thanks.
Right. So what I would say with regard to the statement about nobody shoot nobody, Ms. Dixon, I was just checking the transcript during Ms. Bond's argument, and it's on page, I guess I didn't write down the page number, but Ms. Dixon testified that she made that statement and that other people, including Ms. Stewart, were present. I don't believe Ms. Stewart was ever asked if she heard it. So I think what the record shows is that she was present, but it doesn't necessarily show that she heard it. With regard to the Facebook messages, I guess I do not recall off the top of my head Ms. Stewart being asked if she reviewed those messages, but I may just be misremembering that. It's possible she did. But what I would say is that even if she did, even assuming she heard the statement and reviewed the Facebook messages, it doesn't make her an accomplice as a matter of law, because that goes to more the foreseeability side, which is one aspect of the accomplice liability, whether it was reasonably foreseeable that a gun would be used. But in terms of whether she knew there was going to be an assault, there her testimony is pretty equivocal. She goes back and forth. You know, she says she knows that it could end up being a physical fight, but that she also thought that maybe verbally they could just talk it out. She doesn't understand why there would need to be any sort of physical fight about this. Perhaps some of the limited wisdom demonstrated by any of the folks involved in this situation. But on page 491 to 92 of the transcript, she says that she thought the situation between Courtney and Sean might be resolved verbally rather than physically. She said on 492, what she went along to see what the issue was really like. Honestly, if you were all friends, what's the issue? And then page 500 to 503, her testimony talks about not believing that Sean Royster was going to come outside when she got to the house. And then what I think is also really important is her testimony about what happens after they get there, regardless of what she knew.
So I had a question about that. I'm just trying to picture the scene. And so Courtney and Ms. Stewart, their car is in the front of the house, and Courtney goes up to the front door. And then is the kitchen, so it's the house is on a corner. So is the kitchen facing the other street? So it's like 90 degrees. So it's not like the other car is in the back of the house in an alley.
No, it's confusing. So I would refer you, if you want to visualize it, and I kind of regret not including this in my brief, actually, exhibits 1 and 2 from the trial record are maps that show where these things are taking place. And I think they're really helpful because it is confusing. So as I understand it,
Ms. Stewart said that she heard a male voice to say get back in the car seconds before the gunshots rang out. So that's coming from a car that's 90 degrees essentially from where the front of the house is.
Correct. But the shots come from that car, from that direction. So the truck it's also confusing, of course, because some of the people are switching vehicles before they get there too. So that doesn't help. But my understanding is that Ms. Stewart starts driving her car, the Hyundai Sonata, there, but then for whatever reason, people stop before they get there, they switch cars, she gets into this truck that one of the other people owns. That truck parks across the street. I believe it's across from the, I believe it's across Addison Way, or it's on the other cross street from where the car is, whichever one it is. And the car that the appellant was in, along with Corey Dixon, parked right in front of basically the kitchen window area, which is not the same street that the truck is parked on. So they're parked on two separate streets, and the shots go in through the kitchen window. So from where the car is parked, from that area, not where the truck that Ms. Stewart is in was parked. So that is, as I understand it, sort of the factual scenario. So she's out of the car and Sean Royster never comes out of the house, and she testifies she doesn't think he's going to. And then she testifies that neighbors start coming outside and the situation just doesn't look right. She tells Courtney Dixon that this whole thing is pointless. The situation looks bad. And then the shots ring out at that point. So she's in a position where, at least according to her testimony, which the jury, I guess under the case law, is free to credit or not credit. She, by her testimony, she's saying, you know, this is weird. Let's get out of here, guys, basically. And then shots ring out and then everybody gets out of there at that point, obviously. So the state's position is really that her testimony is just plain old equivocal on this issue. What she knew and when she knew it. And that makes her maybe an accomplice,
Mr.
maybe not.
Dukovich, just assume that we agree with you for the moment and the district court didn't make a mistake on how he handled Ms. Stewart as an accomplice in submitting it to the jury. So going to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, if I understand Ms. Bond's argument correctly, she is saying that while corroboration of an accomplice's testimony doesn't have to be point for point, it does have to directly tie the defendant to the actual crime, and that really the state has, although it has a lot of corroboration, and your brief does a good job laying out various points that are corroborated, Ms. Courtney's testimony is the only evidence of Mr. Jones's intent, which is necessary for the assault, right?
I
just want to hear your response. I'm not making the argument. I just want to make sure I understand your position on it. And what is the corroboration? Because we don't get all of Courtney's, what Courtney provides in terms of the defendant's evidence of his guilt isn't completely matched, certainly, by what Ms. Stewart says. So you're not home free. So help me out. Thanks.
Sure. Well, what I would say in that is two things. First of all, the statement that the appellant makes to Ms. Dixon, I would concede, is probably the only direct evidence of his intent. But I wouldn't say it's the only evidence of his intent. And what I mean by that is that if we assume, and I'll get to the evidence in a moment, but if we assume for the moment that he's the shooter, the act of firing the gun is in of itself, I think, sufficient to show intent for the purposes of the assault statute. There was no claim that the gun discharged accidentally or anything like that. And the act of firing a gun is in itself, I think, pretty good evidence of intent that one would cause the natural and probable consequences of their actions of shooting a gun. So with regard to the evidence that does show the appellant was the shooter, and I agree that the evidence is very much pointing to the appellant as the shooter rather than playing some other role, the vast majority of that evidence, I would submit, is independent of any even arguable accomplice testimony. So we know that the appellant and Corey Dixon drove to the house in the white Hyundai. That's from Ms. Stewart, but also from Darius Bell, who the appellant is not claiming to be an accomplice, page 551 to 52. We know from Mr. Bell that the appellant was the passenger in the passenger seat on the way to the Royster's home. We know that Corey Dixon and the appellant parked the car in front of the Royster's home, sort of in line with the kitchen window. That's from Ms. Stewart's testimony, as well as Mr. Bell. So again, not relying on accomplices, even arguably. And then as what I was getting to earlier with regard to the sort of visualization of the scene is significant. So according to the testimony, the passenger side, so the car is parked on the same side of the street as the house, right across sort of the yard from the kitchen window. It's more or less in line or close to in line with it. Page 497, Ms. Stewart talks about the passenger side being next to the curb facing the home. Exhibits 1 and 2, as I said, are helpful in evaluating that and visualizing it. And at page 295, Eugene Royster also testifies that the car was right in front of the window. Most of the shell casings are found in the boulevard or in the yard right adjacent to that area, basically, is what the testimony shows. The transcript at 819 to 822 and exhibits 52 to 58. And so that's right next to where the car is parked on the passenger side. Eugene Royster testified that he saw two black males near the car moments before he was shot, page 287 and 290. This is the one place where Ms. Dixon's testimony comes in, but it's not necessary, where the appellant tells her that he jumps into the car before they took off. Then when the people in the car meet up and switch cars again after the shooting, the appellant's in the passenger seat of the car. That's again, Mr. Bell's testimony, and Corey Dixon is driving. We also know from the Spriegel evidence that the appellant had access to a gun that could fire those type of bullets, and there was no evidence that Corey Dixon did. We have the fact that he hid from the police's consciousness of guilt. And we have the fact that the jury rejected his testimony, which was that he wasn't even in the same city as the shooting, much less present at the scene, much less the shooter. We have the jury's clear rejection of that as additional consciousness of guilt evidence. So the state's position is all of that evidence does corroborate Courtney Dixon's testimony, and it corroborates it quite convincingly. It shows a very high likelihood that he was indeed the shooter, and frankly, very little of that relies on accomplice testimony, and I'd submit nothing necessary. We have the area where the bullets are found and where he is in the car. I see I'm out of time. I thank the court.
Need to unmute. Thank you, Mr. Hajdukovic. And Ms. Bond, you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Almost everything that I just heard opposing counsel recite there shows the circumstances of the offense. And what is very troubling about this case, I think, is that it is, and I have had a lot of aiding and abetting cases and a lot of, but we have almost no evidence as to what my client did at the scene, other than what Courtney says. And so it heightens the need for corroboration of what he did at the scene, because that is what's required under the law. We can't, so the trajectory evidence and the placement of the cars and everything else, for sure, that corroborates what Courtney says happened as far as there was a shooting into the house and Mr. Royster sustained great bodily harm. But again, we have this very significant absence of evidence as to whether my client was the shooter or what he might have done to intentionally aid Corey if he's not. And
so, Ms. Bond, the argument that Mr. Hajdukovic, I think, articulated here and in his brief is that it's a reasonable inference from the fact that Mr. Jones was established as a passenger in the vehicle by several witnesses, certainly not just Courtney or Ms. Stewart, that because he was a passenger and the shooting based on physical evidence did happen, the shooter was standing outside the vehicle, that he's the obvious person. And then of course we have his statements that he jumped into the vehicle. But setting those statements aside, that there's other evidence that makes it logical for the jury to reach that inference. And given our standard of review on appeal, we would credit that inference.
Well, the problem is that he could have been, and I agree the evidence at this stage supports the inference that my client was the passenger in the car. I think that's that we have to accept that state of the evidence. But we don't know, he could have been out of the car and not been the shooter and not done anything to aid Corey, as Corey was the shooter. And that's why the evidence is so slim in this case. And so it doesn't rule out the inference if we're in aiding and abetting land that he was merely present. And if we're in principal liability land, the fact that there is a reasonable inference that he was outside the car doesn't corroborate the offense, which is what's required under the statute, that my client was the one who discharged the gun. So those pieces of evidence, I would submit, certainly don't go far enough. The only thing I guess I would say, I think we've talked a good amount about Ms. Stewart's status as an accomplice or not. The only, I guess, two follow-up points I would make based on opposing counsel's presentation. One is that really what Ms. Stewart testifies about what she thought might happen or how this altercation might resolve, I really think is not the appropriate focus. Because that doesn't speak to what she knew about Courtney's intent. So Courtney can take off with the intent to commit an assault, and Ms. Stewart can lend her car to the people who are part of it and thereby make herself an aider and abettor, but she still could think, well, maybe it won't come to that. Maybe something else will happen. But what, so her speculation as to outcome does not answer the question about what she knew about Courtney's intent at the time she took steps to help aid the commission of the crime. The last thing I would say about the Ms. Stewart is one of the reasons this issue has always been troubling for me is that if I take away Zuri Stewart and in her place, I put one of my clients, I think there's no question that this evidence is sufficient to charge and convict of aiding and abetting. I see it in my cases all the time. Somebody knows there's going to be a fight, knows that a gun might be involved, goes along, lends a car that is used as a decoy and a getaway car. That is sufficient to charge and convict of aiding and abetting, and that's something that I see quite frequently. For those reasons, I would ask that the convictions be reversed, or alternatively, that the court reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you to both attorneys. The matters were well briefed, and the arguments will assist us in our determination of outcome. That concludes our Zoom Gov cases for today. Thank you for appearing.
Thank you. Judges.